Imagine a 26-year-old coming from a rich family whose dad is the leader of one of India's largest companies. And at 26, he's gifted the reins to Royal Enfield. He has little to no work experience, just came out of school and is suddenly handed all that power. And not just to any little company, but to a company with a huge history behind it. I mean, Royal Enfield is the oldest manufacturer of motorcycles that, since its inception, has been producing two-wheeled motor vehicles. No pressure, right?
If this is not nepotism, privilege at its finest, I don't know what is. Yeah, that was my perspective when I first found out about the headline of the articles. And I bet that was yours too when listening to this intro. It's a stereotype.
And sure, a lot of stereotypes have deep roots into the real world. But this one, this is the exception. Because for once, this kid did it right.
This is a story of a motorcycle company sentenced to death row, of a college kid who, out of nowhere, took control and managed to take the brand back to its glory days.
I was exceedingly naive when I went in. I was 27. I knew nothing about the world. I knew nothing about business. I'd done no finance. I had nothing, you know, I didn't know what working capital meant. So I really went into the deep end thinking, how tough can it be to just sell a few more motorcycles, right? When I went in and I saw the depths of the problems, I saw the, you know, that was the deep end.
But in order to understand this revival, we first have to understand how deep was the septic tank that Royal Enfield was drowning in. I'm not going to go into its full history, since honestly, that's not the point. So just as a couple highlights. It all started in 1901 in England. Later, they even produced the Flying Flea, a special bike designed to be parachuted into the front lines during times of war. In 1949, a company called Madras Motors became the official Indian importer of Royal Enfield motorcycles. A bit later, long story short, the UK company dies
and the Indian one tries to keep the Enfields afloat, manufacturing them in their Asian homeland. As years go by, competition from Yamaha, Jawa, and the other Japanese brands start to strangle Enfield.
And they choke themselves even harder, keeping a lot of manual assembly, which led to big inconsistencies and slowdowns. And so, we get to the early 90s, with a motorcycle brand that's bleeding out of all holes.
And this is where our story really starts. In the 90s, Royal Enfield was really struggling, on the brink of bankruptcy.
That's when, in 94, the Eicher Group acquires the brand, mainly out of the CEO's passion for it. They didn't have a plan or anything, but it gave Enfield a few more years. And in those years, nothing really changed. And you know the definition of insanity, doing the exact same thing twice and expecting different results. Well, in this case, the results were the same.
The thing is, the Eicher Group consisted of a lot of varying businesses, from clothes, food exports, commercial trucks, and another 11 companies that all did something different.
So you can see why a struggling bike brand wasn't a top priority. And so, as the 2000s rolled around, they were months away from closing down the historic motorcycle brand. A brand that had a history of almost a century. A brand that influenced bike riders, wars, history. All of that was going to be buried to rest.
The problem was, back then, the Enfields were simply not that good.
They were riddled with issues right from the moment they left the assembly line. I mean, common problems consisted of engine seizures, oil leaks, breaking of clutch and throttle cables, electric failures, and the list goes on and on and on. A couple years before, in 99, Sid Lal, the son of the CEO, joined his father's company working with their tractor division. And a few months later, in 2000, he was appointed the CEO of Royal Enfield. Spoiled kids, right?
Well, not exactly. To quote Sid,
"The board agreed to give me a chance. It was not because of its confidence in me, but because the business was doing so badly, it could hardly get any worse."
Turning Enfield around was a monumental task, and even worse, he only had 2 years to do it. In the corporate world, 2 years to change a company's destiny is close to nothing. But that was all the board was willing to lose. 2 years.
In this time, Sid had to show that Royal Enfield could be saved, saved from itself.
Honestly, at age 26, it seemed a fun thing to do. I could eat, sleep, ride, and talk motorcycles.
So his first action was to take a holiday and ride around India?
Sid got himself a Royal Enfield and just started riding around, putting thousands and thousands of kilometers on the bike, talking to people, making friends. And while this sounds stupid, childish, it was a genius move. You see, Sid wanted to see for himself what it was like owning a Royal Enfield, what it was like riding one. And soon, he quickly found out why their reputation was down in the toilet.
Even on his one example, just a few months after leaving the assembly line, his bike started breaking down, and not just once.
When he found out about the repair costs and time it would have taken, he knew that this was even worse than he anticipated. That's when he realized that Enfield wasn't a company in need of reinvention. At first, he had to stop the bleeding. One of his first moves was dropping all of management's company cars and replacing them with Royal Enfield motorcycles.
This was a way to make everyone see what he had seen, to have first-hand experience of all the problems.
He closed down their Jaipur plant, cut all dealer discounts. He immediately halted any new models and started fixing the core issues of their existing ones. He even addressed fundamental issues like the gear shifter. You see, back then, the Enfields had the gear shifter on the right and the back brake on the left side of the motorcycle. Things that pure enthusiasts loved, as it made them unique, but also a thing that kept everyone else away from an Enfield. This previous gatekeeping was killing the potential mass appeal of their motorcycles. And then, for the quality, Sid brought in a Japanese consultant to help their post-production quality assurance. They took 1,000 bikes, made the 1,000 line checklist, and went through it all.
On every single bike. It took two people more than 4 hours to do the checks on a single motorcycle. But this extreme measure was needed.
Sid loved this challenge, and the brand started slowly getting better, started healing. Obviously, it was no overnight miracle, but it was improving step by step. The bleeding was down to the last bandage. He was not a backseat driver. Between 2000 and 2004, he actually worked and lived at the Chennai headquarters. Even in 2002, when flooding forced them to pause all production, Sid was there, together with all his employees. And yet, none of what I told you before is even remotely as extreme as his next action.
In 2004, his father approached Sid with the intention to convince his son to take over the entire Eicher Group. And yet, Sid didn't really want to initially.
And I was like, no, I don't want to like leave this place. This is like, I'm enjoying myself here now at Royal Enfield, and I'm really having a blast. And you know, we're getting somewhere. We're doing interesting things.
After some more convincing, he was finally willing to, but only on his own terms. And one of his terms was radical, to say the least.
I'll do that, but on my terms. And my dad was like, dude, absolutely, you do it on your terms. And my terms were like, I said, we need to look at our entire portfolio, Eicher's entire business, from a clean sheet of paper again.
The Eicher Group had 15 companies operating beneath, Royal Enfield being one of them. And Sid didn't like that. So he killed 13 of the 15 total.
If you look at it, actually, we were just mediocre. We were in 15 different businesses. We weren't doing exceptionally well in any one business. We were basically a mediocre firm, and we didn't want to face that reality.
13 companies were instantly shut down. I mean, one of those was even the company that was started by his grandfather. The company that started the Eicher Group. But no, that had to go, leaving just the motorcycle division and their truck division.
In my mind, the basic question was this. Do we want to be a mediocre player in 15 small businesses, or just be good in one or two businesses?
And Sid picked Royal Enfield to stay for multiple reasons. You see, between all the problems he initially found and started fixing, he stumbled over a great group of people, passionate people. They had a strong employee culture and some money from their parent group, and that was enough to give Sid the confidence that Enfield could rise back from the ashes.
Look, I mentioned Siddhartha Lal a lot, or Sid for short. I tried portraying him as the stereotypical rich kid that inherited everything. Because, at first, it kinda sounds like it.
But Sid was different. His entire family had entrepreneurship deeply running through their blood. His dad ran a business, his mom did the same. And his dad never pressured him into joining the family company.
But our family is not a very typical business family. So my father, mother, sisters and me, when we were growing up, we weren't talking about business all the time.
Then at 17, Sid came home one day to see his dad's new, bright red Royal Enfield standing in the garage.
And that's when his own two-wheel passions ignited.
A Royal Enfield was the bike that started Sid's passion. And true passion it was, he took multiple motorcycle trips to the Himalayas, Europe and many other places.
Sid was a real biker, with a real story so similar to many of ours, in a way.
And then, he was a smart kid too. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Delhi, then moved to a postgraduate diploma at the Cranfield University in mechanical engineering, and later did a master's at the University of Leeds in automotive engineering. So he had the background of learning economics, engineering, automotive. In a way, this was the perfect cocktail mix that could save the motorcycling company. And then, after finishing his studies, he even went and worked for MAN Trucks for a few months, to try and gather some real-world experience.
This was not your average spoiled kid that inherited everything. He was a highly educated, highly motivated one. A rarity in a way, but exactly the man that could bring a fresh face to the Enfield brand.
Okay, fixing issues with production, sales is one thing. Not easy to do, but where do you go from there? You stop the bleeding, but the company's future is still kinda gray.
Evolving that takes a completely different skill set, takes setting a vision for the future. And Sid, he had that vision, and he was not about to settle down.
In 2010, he decided to consolidate all manufacturing efforts into one platform, the Classic 500. Basically, from now on, all Enfield models would be based off this motorcycle. This was a huge gamble. I mean, do it right and you save a ton of costs and improve efficiency.
But get this platform wrong? Then you're done. And Royal Enfield's name stops being mentioned in bike magazines and joins the history books.
Luckily though, it worked. Later in 2015, they acquired the British company Harris Performance, renowned for their chassis work on MotoGP and WSBK bikes. They hired multiple experienced people, like Ducati designer Pierre Terblanche, or Triumph engine development lead James Young. They brought in Rod Copes, an ex-Harley manager.
And this is just scratching the surface, because their hunger for R&D talent was even bigger.
They opened up a new technology center in the UK near Leicester, conveniently closer to the city than Triumph's close by headquarters. This was meant as a way to attract more talent from the British competition, but also a way for them to be closer to the Western market.
Which was about to be their ultimate ambition.
They started sponsoring off-road rallies, created communities of passionate, loyal Enfield enthusiasts. And so, by 2015, they had overtaken Harley-Davidson in global sales. For reference, in 2012, they were selling roughly 100,000 motorcycles each year.
That number, in just 10 years, skyrocketed to 920,000 units.
And by doing this, Sid managed to erase most of the company's debt. Enfield was afloat and aiming for the stars.
And then there is the brand vision, which is arguably the most important. It all started back in the UK, right after Sid took control of Enfield.
He got the chance to drive a regular Mini, and that was the moment our young CEO realized what his motorcycles were supposed to become. He took inspiration from brands like Porsche, Mini. He learned from them how to embrace and make use of your heritage, while keeping a fresh, modern feel compared to your competition.
He recognized the company's Indian heritage with pride and started creating real tight communities around that brand.
And all that translated into a different way of marketing and selling motorbikes.
We did not want to put a big photo of a bike, the features, the price, and say, "I'm here, come and get me if you want."
Sid swore to never try selling a spec sheet. Instead, he focused on selling the experience, the community, the emotion.
And then, when he turned his attention towards the Western markets, he realized another thing.
When buying such classic-looking motorcycles, people want to feel like they belong. And so, he started building these incredibly designed showrooms all around the world, filled with bikes and gear. But not just any gear. They went to manufacture their own street-looking motorcycle garments, including boots, jackets, helmets, gloves, everything.
This was Sid's idea of selling the experience. And sure, this was super cool for the customer, but it was good for the dealers too.
Now, look, they could make their money on bikes and service, but they also had a plethora of lifestyle accessories to go with it. And this allowed them to have these showrooms even in smaller cities all around the world. These places were a crucial part of transforming Royal Enfield's image from an old, dusted, scrappy brand into this modern, full-of-life entity.
And all this vision came from a simple principle that Sid had. Basically, he never really cared about the next 3 to 5 years. Any meaningful plan had to be long-term, 10, 20, 30 years.
Sure, short-term patching may be required from time to time, but in order to evolve, Enfield had to see way ahead. And Sid did just that. Ultimately, he said that he sees in Indian manufacturers the same opportunity that the Japanese had a few decades ago. They have a solid foundation, resources, and vision is the only thing hindering them from taking over the motorcycling world.
And you know what? I can't really fault that logic.
That being said, I would argue that their first step towards global recognition came in 2016, when the Himalayan was released. This is one of Enfield's most important motorcycles when it comes to their global expansion. It managed to bring the attention of young Westerners to the brand.
It was a way for regular people to experience adventure, joy, without the side effect of credit card debt.
But funny enough, it was never meant to be like that. The original idea was seeded by Sid himself as a small adventure touring dual sport. In 2010, Sid got stranded by flash floods when taking a trip through the Himalayas. And that's when he realized that your regular adventure bikes were just not right for that terrain. Too big, too complicated, they only worked on premium fuel.
In a nutshell, nobody was making the right tool for crossing the Himalayas. And that's how the Himalayan project was born.
In his own words, the point of this bike was never to conquer the mountains, but to flow along with them. It's a beautiful way of describing the end product, and I'd argue it's the perfect metaphor. They made it simple, easy to fix. I mean, heck, you can bump start a Himalayan and have it run with a headlight on without even inserting a battery.
And then when the first prototype was finished, Sid himself took it on a Himalayan trip. He was the definition of a hands-on CEO, one that is passionate about his work.
And so, in 2016, the Himalayan was officially unveiled. The design was simple, robust, rugged, and beautiful in its own unique way. I'm saying that as a good thing though, because their South African designer, Pierre Terblanche, was a bit controversial.
Sure. He did used to work for Kajiva, Moto Guzzi, Norton.
He was the mastermind behind great designs like the Hyper Motard, the Ducati Supermono, the MH900E. But for every one of those, he also designed an original Multistrada or the 999.
Yet with the Himalayan, he kind of nailed the design for its purpose.
Then you had the engine, a 411cc lump putting out a disappointing 25 horsepower. But this gave the bike a huge amount of controllable, low-down torque. And that was the point for the average consumer. The original idea was to downscale this engine later for their other street-oriented Royal Enfields.
And actually, when working on the concept, the Himalayan was never supposed to come out of India. Like, at all.
Honestly, it wasn't meant for international markets. We said it's only for India.
They never looked at other bikes as competitors. They simply designed what they thought was the best machine for tackling the Indian landscape. Most of us, my viewers outside of India, were never supposed to get this lightweight adventure bike. But yet again, Sid had a revelation.
It was the first time that a lure mid-size, 400-odd cc adventure tourer, was a full-blooded adventure tourer.
Yeah.
Because all the other manufacturers till then said, guys, our big bikes, they're full-blooded adventure tourers. Our small bikes, you know what, we're going to give you something that looks adventure. It's actually a soft roader. It's actually not a real adventure. We're not going to give the tires, the suspension, the handling, the ergonomics. It's basically a city bike dressed up to look like an adventure, right? So,
see, in his European trips, he noticed that small bore adventure bikes weren't really adventure bikes at all. I mean, a lot of manufacturers weren't even building such thing, but even the ones that did,
they were basically road bikes with fancy off-road looking fairings, and that was about it. They weren't capable of real adventures. And when he realized that, Sid knew the Himalayan had to go global. They built one of the most approachable seat heights of the segment, with enough ground clearance and comfort from the 21-inch front wheel, something basically unheard of in the small adventure category. The ergonomics were designed to work both while sitting and standing, because, you know, rough terrain demands standing up a lot of the time. They gave it a long range via its 15-liter tank and great fuel consumption figures, mounted factory rails for jerrycans and luggage.
Really, this was an adventure bike that you could take and actually adventure on it, without the extra cost and intimidation of other models.
The Himalayan is the start of a new era and very important chapter for Royal Enfield.
Now, look. The first years of the Himalayan weren't just sunshine and roses. They still had plenty of reliability and quality control issues.
And that is kind of to be expected when a company enters a completely new realm. And Sid was aware of them and promised himself to never release something as unbaked again.
But they quickly worked on the issues, improving them month by month. And despite all the drawbacks, the simplicity, ease of use and peace of mind, combined with the amazing price point, made the Himalayan a huge success in all markets. This bike represented a new way for people to go on adventures, to explore. It was a gateway for so many riders to get into this off-road world.
Sure, the Himalayan meant a lot to Royal Enfield, but it meant even more for its devoted riders. It enabled them to go places where they could only dream of.
I just take it out wherever I can and whenever I can. Yeah. People were jammed everywhere, so I just took it through all the kind of trails I could. There was water all over, it doesn't make a difference. Everyone was stuck except me.
It's not just a machine, it's a partner which goes, you know, with you on almost every ride.
The only thing that I do desire is a chance to ride the Himalayan one more time.
You know, rarely comes a vehicle that changes the landscape as much as the Himalayan did. That changes perceptions. And yet, Royal Enfield did just that.
In the past years, the motorcycle company grew to represent as much as 90% of the profits of the entire Eicher Group, and they're only going up.
Are they perfect? No, obviously not. From time to time, quality issues still pop up. People still desire more, sure. But if you look where this company started 20 years ago, you can't help but be wishful and hopeful for the future.
They are giving people what they really want, and at a price point they can actually afford. They're answering a request that most Western manufacturers have been ignoring. The quest for simplicity, price, and looks. And all of this was possible because of one 26-year-old CEO, Sid Lal.
Thanks a lot for watching. If you're interested in more similar stories, you can check out the one about Husaberg and how that had a slightly less happy fate. Have a good one. Cheers.